Well, there was loads on the radio, from the problem with pigeon poo, an epic voyage to Antarctica, and being a parent with mental illness. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I became really fixated that I was possessed, okay, and that was what was wrong with me. And that would actually was what had always been wrong with me, because I have been unwell on and off for over 10 years.
Spiders are great travellers, and they'll stow away in these places. And a female spider could have an egg sac with a couple of hundred babies, and then you've got a population, and then they just, if they find the conditions favourable, they kick off.
But I do like pigeons, Joe. I love to hear them. Wood pigeons now. And you can eat them. They're nice. I wouldn't eat an empty pigeon.
And we'll start here. On Today with Claire Byrne, writer and novelist Sophie White was talking about opening up about mental illness and the reaction to her writing about her diagnosis of bipolar 2 as a parent of young children.
So, Sophie, this piece that you've written, it's the first time that you've said publicly that your mental illness is bipolar 2. And that diagnosis you were given about a year ago, is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
So what is that? How does that affect you, both in terms of having bipolar 2 and being told that you have bipolar 2?
Well, bipolar 2, it sort of seems to affect me in kind of a way that I can have very acute, quite severe episodes of, it starts with a sense of high almost. I can become quite manic in my head, manic in my thoughts. Even speaking, like, I can sometimes find, like, my speech becomes, I feel like it's a weird way to describe it, but slippy. It's almost like the words are coming out, like, out of my control a bit. It's a sense of, I think, losing the reins a bit, being on a kind of galloping horse, and it's going along feeling great, actually, you know, for quite a period of time. I feel quite like high off it, really energized. I can, like, I feel really amazing, actually. Sometimes I can feel like the best I've ever felt right before, like, you know, I veer off the cliff altogether, kind of.
Do you sleep?
Yes, I do, but it can feel like you need less sleep, less food, less. It's a strange state, and it is an altered state, even though when I'm in it, sometimes I find it a bit hard to recognize that I'm in it. And I'm really lucky. I have a lot of really great people around me who can really identify my triggery behaviors. Actually, sometimes my husband would come to me sometimes, like, you know, about 2 in the afternoon and be like, have you had breakfast? Because it would be stuff like that, that you kind of, that can really, like, strangely become a bit like they fall by the wayside. You're kind of not, I'm not in a good organized space in my head where I'm taking care of myself. I get quite kind of, I suppose I can become laser focused on an idea if I get into that kind of state. And sometimes that idea can be great. Like, I might start a new podcast, or I'm going to write this thing that I'm working on, or whatever. And sometimes those ideas can get, like, a very strange slant on them. I suppose, to give people an example of, I guess, just how out there it can sometimes get. In 2018, in the autumn of 2018, I had quite an acute episode. I really hadn't recognised that it was coming on, and I was alone with my three children, two children. My husband was away working, and I became, like, really fixated that, this is going to sound, stay with me, Claire. I became really fixated that I was possessed, okay, and that was what was wrong with me. That was what had always been wrong with me, because I have been unwell on and off for over 10 years. And I've had these very acute episodes. And I suppose.
So did you feel then I found the answer in that moment?
Like a little bit, but also I wasn't delighted by what the answer I appeared to have settled on was. And I think I'm lucky that at that point, in that episode, I had enough sort of, like, left in me to kind of say, oh, it's not great now that you think you're possessed right now. Better do something about this.
And what did you do?
Well, actually, at the time, that night, I locked myself in my bedroom. So my children were in their bedrooms sleeping. I kind of managed to get it together to kind of put them to bed. And I then went up to my room and locked myself in my room. I was not, I mean, I think it's safe to say, people understand, this is not the thoughts of a rational person right now. Like,
of course,
I didn't pick up the phone, for example, and ring my mother, who is very close by, unbelievably supportive and understanding. I just, in that moment, felt that I needed to physically restrain myself, basically, and that was the safest option here in this state that I was in.
It sounds really frightening.
It was terrifying. It is terrifying. Like, you know, being mentally ill is, it's just such a prison, because you can't, you know, you can't amputate your brain. You know, you can't, you know, you can't kill off the bad bit and keep the good bits of your brain. You're really stuck with the whole thing. And I think as well, I remember very, very much when I first got ill when I was in my early 20s, it took me so long to come back to a place of even in any way being able to trust myself or my own brain again after that first episode, because it's like when you have a pet and it's the beloved family pet and then it bites someone and then you all don't know how you can ever trust that pet again, for example. It's like that. Your brain attacks you, and then you also need your brain very much for everything. So it's awful when we treat it in any way as secondary to, I suppose, how it's sometimes sort of delineated as like physical illness, because mental illness is, of course, physical illness too.
And Sophie was 35 before she got her diagnosis.
It was bizarrely reassuring, even though, you know, like a phrase like bipolar, it does carry a lot of fear and stigma, or certainly did to me. It was definitely something that, you know, I'd come across, I'd often gone, is it that? And almost been afraid to look directly at it. And certainly because it seemed to describe a lot of what my life was like. But when I was kind of given the diagnosis, it actually was quite reassuring, because it was finally giving name to something that up until then had been very nebulous, quite frightening. And so I just suppose it's quite terrifying not knowing what's wrong with you. Anyone who is seeking any kind of medical treatment knows that, and I'm sure probably are listening and hopefully maybe nodding and saying yes. Like, it's awful not knowing, and to be given a diagnosis also means more focused treatment for exactly what's wrong with you, and, you know, new medication. It means a bit of hope, actually.
I was just looking at the difference between what you went through with your first baby and then your subsequent two children. So the first time, you didn't seek out help in the maternity services the first time, isn't that right?
Yeah.
And then that changed for the second two, and there was a huge difference.
Yeah, massively so. I mean, when I was writing that essay last weekend, I did really want to make sure that it wasn't in any way this kind of wholesale condemnation of our services, because they have worked for me so many times, you know, when I've really needed them. For example, so in my first pregnancy, I was really afraid to say I had a history of mental illness in the kind of, you know, opening kind of, you know, questions that you get when you go to the midwives. And, you know, I thought like that they might try and preemptively confiscate this baby, or, you know, I just don't know. I think there is a lot of fear, and I think it's a reasonable fear, because we live in a country that is in a hangover from some very dark times when, you know, women didn't have autonomy. And, you know, so I think it's reasonable for mothers in Ireland, and I think that should be acknowledged. It's not irrational, but at the same time, the services are so on the side of parents and families and mothers, and like, I see that very much so. But it's just a kind of an animal fear, you know. When it comes to your baby, you know, you just, it's, there is like, you know, logic kind of almost can't come into it, really. And then I suppose subsequently, you know, I had my first baby. I was in my late 20s. It wasn't, I suppose it wasn't a planned pregnancy. And I did begin to suffer, you know, quite a lot in my head towards the kind of like late pregnancy. Got very, very hyper-focused on kind of it's going to sound sort of weird to say, but I kind of became kind of phobic of all the baby things that we had amassed. So, you know, I was heavily pregnant. I couldn't go into the baby's room that we had all the kind of little tiny clothes in. There was this changing mat that had a picture of a giraffe on it. I had to hide it. It gave me so much terror. And then I think the fact that it was giving me this response started a cycle of just terror and paranoia. And yes, very so already quite unwell before I had the baby.
And Claire asked Sophie about her article, I Have What She Has.
I want to talk to you about Deirdre Morley and how that trial and everything that has emerged since then impacted you. And I know you were hyper aware in the piece that you wrote that you didn't want to insert yourself into somebody else's life and their story, but it was important for you to identify with those words that are so powerful, I have what she had. What are you saying when you say that?
I am saying that I have I suppose a similar mental illness. I have a similar trajectory in that I've been hospitalized for my mental illness in the same way that she was. I am saying that I have the same broken system that she has. And I'm saying that mothers in Ireland have the same broken system. I think that's what I really wanted to say with I have what she has, we have what she had. It's an untenable circumstances right now for, I think, Irish families in so many ways. And I suppose I just wanted to just, I suppose, bring this context of, you know, we have done so much great work in terms of mental illness awareness. But I think awareness without action is so dangerous because it's really letting us off the hook. Mm-hmm. Because we say, well, we're aware now.
And we respond, we say things, and we've heard people saying it, you know, from politicians to people we meet in our everyday lives, it's shocking. It's awful.
Yeah.
You know, we can't imagine what they're going through, and we can't.
No.
But that, you say, is not enough.
It's not. I think it's just so dangerous. And it's so devastating that it's taken an event and a tragedy like this to really vividly and so, so sadly illustrate how dangerous it is to underestimate in any way the severity of mental illness. And I suppose it's amazing the profound courage of Andrew McGinley and Una Butler, who are doing so much tangible work in this area now, and it is so incredible. I'm so grateful to them, you know, in terms of campaigning for kind of advocacy and you know, including spouses and family in patient care. And that is really concrete, excellent, you know, a direction we can take for sure. And I think it's just that I want to sort of say, as much as we can look at the mental health services as needing reform, and there are incredible groups working on that in this country, I also feel like we need to, and I hate this phrase because it's so tired, but we need a holistic approach in that we ask women to do so much as mothers. We don't, as a country, I feel, give enough. I feel that things like maternity benefit is, you know, it's a problem, I think, when you need to, for example, declare it as income if you self-assess, as I do.
Mm-hmm. The pressure of finding childcare and paying for childcare.
Exactly. I mean, the ECHI system is so appreciated, but I do feel a bit like we're in kind of, it's like Dickens, like, please, sir. Like, I don't know if like 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for 8 months is the incredible childcare solution the government thinks it is. And I don't want to rant because any help is obviously enormous help. But, you know, it's a lot of financial burden as well, you know, just having children and being in the workplace.
Yeah.
Sophie White, writer and novelist, from Today with Claire Byrne. Now listen up, arachnophobes. Someone who makes spiders sound charming until you realise he's talking about venomous ones. Dr. Michel Dugan, head of the Venom Systems Lab at NUI Galway, on the noble false widow spider.
The spider arrived was reported for the first time in 1997. So it is a very recent import to the Irish fauna.
But now it's pretty much widespread around the country?
Yes, so this is something that really amazes us, how this spider has managed to just take over so many suburban and urban habitats all throughout the country within 20 years or so.
Okay, so it's now the dominant spider in Ireland, is it? Or one of them?
Yes, and this is what is somewhat frightening, both on an ecological and health point of view, is that this spider has become now probably the most prevalent species of spider in and around Dublin, and is become more and more prevalent in the rest of the country as well.
And you run the marvellously interesting-sounded Venom Systems Laboratory at NUI Galway, so you've been looking at the venom in this spider's bite, and what have you found out?
So, regarding the venom, we actually discovered that this species possess about two-thirds of its toxin in common with the real black widow. So this already kind of gave us a bit of an alarm. And then we started to investigate really bite cases, people who said that they were bitten by spiders. We actually recovered the sample of the spiders that bit those people. We followed the medical cases, and we had to recognize actually the medical importance of this spider as well. The fact that it can, in some circumstances, in some rare cases, really hurt people as well.
And what kind of side effects would I get from a bite from this noble false widow spider?
So most people would actually experience what we consider fairly mild symptoms. So some swelling, redness, quite intense pain, and sometimes a bit of discomfort that can last for a couple of days. But in some cases, in rarer cases, people really feel bad and will start to sweat profusely, will start to have tachycardia, so their heart rate will not be regular anymore. They will have difficulty breathing, and they can also develop fairly important skin conditions that can be quite debilitating for a period of days, weeks, or even months.
Now this bit'll scare you.
The public should know that anyway, we won't be able to get rid of this species anymore. It is here to stay. There are too many of them, and they're too successful in Ireland. So we need to learn how to live with them. And of course, you can, if you spot a false widow spider, you can just capture it and throw it outside your home, further away. You should also, if you have false widows in your home, you should also just have a quick look in your clothes, for example, when you're actually putting your clothes on in the morning. Because most bite cases.
What do you mean?
Happen.
When I'm pulling on my jeans or putting on my boots, I need to give them a shake first in case there's a spider in there?
If you have a sizable population of false widow around your home, yes, I would advise that. Most people that get bitten either in their bed during their sleep or while putting their clothes on in the morning.
Michel, I am not liking the sound of this one little bit, and I'm going straight home to take out the Hoover, but thank you very much.
So myself and Anya won't sleep well tonight. Dr. Michel Dugan, head of the Venom Systems Lab at NUI Galway from Morning Ireland. Then later on the Ray Darcy Show, Collie Ennis was also talking about our new spider residents.
They are originally from the Canaries, and they arrived here without any green passes or anything. they snuck into the country. They snuck in to the UK and Ireland, and they're pretty invasive all throughout Europe, actually, with modern transport, with goods crossing borders and getting on planes and cars and crates and all the stuff we bring into our countries on ships. Spiders are great travellers, and they'll stow away in these places. And a female spider could have an egg sac with a couple of hundred babies, and then you've got a population, and then they just, if they find the conditions favourable, they kick off.
Yeah, and how come, if they're from the Canaries, which we all know because we haven't been able to go there, is a lot warmer and sunnier than Ireland, and how did they adjust to our climate?
Well, basically they hung out with us. They stuck to urban habitats. So if you were to look at a heat map of the country or any country from a satellite point of view and look at the temperatures, it's generally warmer on street levels and around busy, because the heat radiates from people's houses, from trains, all those sources will provide heat and just stop them getting as cold as they'd need to be to right. kill them off. Like I remember the big die-off of Steatota, of these false widows. I remember it was the big freeze we had about 4 years ago. Do you remember that when it was mad snowy?
Yes, yeah.
I saw them dropping like flies, okay. for want of a better word.
Jumping like spiders. Yeah. That's really interesting. So they concentrate on the urban centres which are warmer than the rural places, and that explains why most of these spiders are on the east coast, probably around Dublin in particular.
Yeah, well, they were first discovered in Bray in 97 right. by Miles Nolan, and they seem to have really spread, you know, at an alarming rate right. since yeah. then. Now yeah. they're everywhere. They really are, and the lads have done Trojan work up in Galway. Yeah. Michelle and JP Dunbar have done really great work investigating their spread, but also following up on the cases of the bites to show that they are medically significant and the odd time they can require some treatment. Now, we're not trying to scare people by telling them that. We're not trying to, there's no need to be jumping out your window or setting fire to your house. They don't go out of their way to attack people. It's just good to know in case somebody does get a nip so they can be treated appropriately.
Collie Ennis on The Ray Darcy Show. And on the live line, Joe was talking pigeon, and in particular, the pigeons that were roosting at the car park at a supermarket in Wexford.
Shane, do you understand why Tesco are putting up these nets?
Yeah, I understand what they're doing, yes.
Okay, what are they doing?
Well, if they're in the car park, they're obviously soiling people's cars. There'll be an awful lot of mess off of pigeons.
So?
But pigeons also carry different diseases which can be transmitted to humans, which can be like as in salmonella.
And how are they transmitted, Shane?
Through the dirt, through the
feces. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But you keep pigeons.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
But do you shoot pigeons?
I do. Yeah. Different times of the year, farmers will ring me up and ask me to go and do crop protection for them, shoot wood pigeons or shoot feral pigeons for them.
But Shane, how do you keep pigeons? How are you a pigeon keeper and a pigeon killer at the same time?
Well, do you eat meat, Joe?
Yeah, of course I do, yeah. Well, not of course,
okay.
I do.
No, of course,
very,
but you do,
very,
yeah.
Very little, yeah.
You know, like, you're eating...
I love it.
You eat beef or you eat chicken or you eat ducks
yeah.
or whatever it is. But then you can still appreciate looking at cows in the field or sheep or lambs bouncing about, you know?
So why, the net are the nets to catch and kill the pigeons in Tesco or the nets are there to deter... Like, would the pigeons see the net and then turn back and tell his mates...
No, well, you see, it all depends. If that's an indoor car park and they put up nets and they catch the pigeons in it, there has to be somebody there to go and dispatch the pigeons if they're caught in it or release them, let them out, you know?
But say there isn't a facility.
Here tomorrow, buddy.
What does a pigeon die of if he's caught in the net?
He'll die of starvation or dehydration.
Ah, that's cruel.
Yeah, well, you see, the other part of it is there could be pigeons that have nests in the car park. If they have nests within the car park and they put up a net, they're going to stop the adult pigeons from getting in to feed and feed their youngsters or sit in the eggs or sit in the youngsters and keep them warm. So you can't just do it and just walk away. There's a duty of care. Like, although I shoot pigeons and I shoot crows or rabbits,
yeah.
I don't willingly go out there to cause absolute carnage or be deliberately cruel. Like, there's a job to be done, but there's a duty of care. There's a way to do it.
And why do... You're saying you're shooting pigeons for farmers.
Yeah, yeah.
Why do farmers hate pigeons?
They don't exactly hate them. It's just... In the next, say, 6 or 8 weeks, you're going to look out across the field and it's going to be all golden colour. That's wheat or barley, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens is the pigeons know at a certain time that the crop, the seed, and that's going to be soft and milky. What they'll do is they'll land into the field and they'll start turning the stalks of the crops and bending her over and eat it. And then they'll lay it flat. And they, like, if you get enough pigeons in, they'll do damage to 1 acre in a day. And then every day they'll just keep coming back and coming back until it's completely destroyed. When that's flat, the farmer can't plant harvest that crop because it's flattened into the ground. It's done. It's over with. You know. So.
But Shane, how can you shooting one pigeon deter other pigeons?
Well, I don't shoot one. I'll be there for 8 hours in a day, and I'll shoot up to 100 pigeons in a day.
Oh wow.
Yeah. But nothing goes to waste. I eat the pigeon. If I shoot rabbits, I eat the rabbits. You know, I keep ferrets because I use them to hunt rabbits as well. So I shoot crows. I use them to feed me ferrets throughout the year. Nothing is wasted.
Well, that was Shane. And then Joe talked to the man who put the nets there. Here's Peter.
You did the netting. You are the man.
I am the man.
And you are the company. What was the tender? What were you asked to do?
We were asked, Joe, the reason the netting has been done, it's been done under health and safety because of the droppings that were on the ground, which mm-hmm. people were actually walking through and contaminating and bringing across contamination into the shop.
That's the reason
the thing is done. Yeah, it's to do with health and safety. Now, can I just guarantee, I've just been listening to the show, and I've been dealing with this over the last week or 10 days with people that have been concerned, and I've been dealing the best I can with them. Now, there is escape hatches all throughout the net, completely. We have what's called a bird gate. So when the bird actually walks on the net, yeah. he actually walks on this, falls down through it, and he escapes. No harm done to him whatsoever. No harm. And they are all fitted completely throughout the net. That's what they are. So no birds whatsoever have been harmed. Not one.
Okay. And how does a pigeon know where the escape hatch is?
From walking on the net, because he'll search and look for a way out.
Okay.
He'll walk along the net, and as he walks along the net, there's a little plastic cup. If people want to go in and have a look at it, they're welcome to look at it. It's a little feathered cone, and they actually fall down through it.
So
it allows the bird to escape. They're specially made for netting. Because of the area being so big and because there's so many RSJs, there can be a pigeon, a hive within an RSJ that we're not going
to see. Yeah, in the beams, yeah.
So then when he comes out of that, and unfortunately we mightn't be there, he can escape out of it. Now, it might take him a day or two to escape out of it, but he does. But the other thing, can I say, like, we finished this job over 2 weeks ago, and I have been there as late as yesterday to check and see, has any pigeons been caught behind this net? Last Friday, there was 4 pigeons caught behind the net. As of yesterday, there was not one pigeon left. Every pigeon had escaped that was caught behind it, unharmed, totally unharmed.
But you say they could be caught for a day or two?
They could be caught for a day or two, yes. Yes. But that wouldn't be going to do them any harm whatsoever.
Water, foods, young chicks.
Well, there was no young in it. These were all newly painted RSJs. There was no young there whatsoever.
Okay. And is the
no young. That was all checked for. I dealt with the National Parks and Wildlife. I dealt with Wexford SPCA. I've been in contact with them on a regular basis while this job was going on. They came in to see us.
Okay.
We explained what we were doing. We explained in relation to the system that we have for letting birds escape in case they get caught behind it. And no birds are actually caught behind the net. There is no net behind the net or anything else. Every bird escapes unharmed.
And once the bird escapes, will they come back again?
Well, they come back. Of course they come back, but they can't get back in. So they will move on and they'll move to somewhere else and actually build again somewhere else. As simple as that. It's only in there because it's dry and because they're protected in there.
So they're using the underground car park as a loft, so to speak.
They're using it as a loft, yeah. And unfortunately, like with the droppings that were coming on the ground, it was really in a bad state. So they were power washing the whole time.
And is that what you do, Peter? What type of...
It is. That's my profession. We've been involved with this for 17 years. And we have never... We've gone out of our way and above and beyond to make sure that we never harm any wildlife whatsoever.
Well, that's Peter. Then Joe got a call from Aisling. She's not a big fan of pigeons.
Aisling, go ahead. You hate pigeons as well.
Oh, no, Joe, a wood pigeon, like the first man was talking about, that he shoots and eats. Lovely, lovely to listen to in the early morning and the evening time. But the feral pigeons you get around town, they're an absolute nuisance. You see them in Houston Station. They nearly come and take your sandwich out of your hand.
Yeah.
No, you don't need that kind of thing. And as they put up the net around the car park...
Is it not the circle of life?
Oh, of course it is. We have to live with these things.
Do you not love to hear the cooing of a pigeon?
Oh, I do. A lovely wood pigeon. Absolutely, Joe. It's lovely to listen to. But them old pigeons that you see around town going around with the limps and the wonky eyes and everything, they're full of disease. You see them in Euston Station. You see them in all out car parks, high-story car parks. They're all in the rafters and all. But sure, what their problem was in Wexford was is that the people were going in through the car park and what the pigeons were fouling on the ground were being brought into the supermarket. You can't have that. That problem has to be sorted.
Yeah,
you know, okay. You can't. We've all have to wear masks going in. Pigeons, you know, poo, as you were calling it, on our feet. No, we can't have that. You know, it's not health and safety. You know, but I do like pigeons, Joe. I love to hear them. Wood pigeons now. And you can eat them. They're nice. I wouldn't eat an old city pigeon.
That's Aisling there. Now, have you heard of pigeon fancier's lung? Well, Paul has.
There's a condition known as pigeon fancier's lung. Now, there's a medical term on it, but that's well known.
But it's very rare.
Hey, and it's not very rare. I'm sorry, it's not. But there, because a lot of people don't know they have it. It's very hard to diagnose. And
if you don't know you have it, what does it what does it do to you?
Well, it's fatigue, breathlessness, general malaise. Like people, it's like ME, would affect people like ME.
And do you know anyone who ever got pigeon fancier's lung?
I do.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that then.
Now, normally what arrives...
So why don't we ban pigeons then?
Well, it's a matter of people take... we could ban lots of things that are dangerous, like motor cars and things like that. So,
yeah, well, motor cars and engines will get you from... an accident to a hospital in three minutes. You know, motor cars in the main are good.
Yeah, but George, is an acceptable level of benefit to people. And it's like, if what is known as the poor man's racehorse, the pigeons and so on. But if people who keep pigeons, this normally affects people who keep pigeons.
Okay, it's called PFL, Pigeon Fancier's Lung.
When they clean out the pigeon houses, they get exposed.
Unless
they wear proper masks and so on to protect them from breathing in the fungus. Okay. The fungus is within the droppings of.
Well, where I come from in Dublin, every second house had a pigeon loft. Every second house. I never heard of anyone with PFL.
Yeah, well, that's it. If you look into it, that's it. But it's very hard to diagnose. A lot of people are sent on for lots of tests, other things, and sometimes it goes away because they're not able to continue with the pigeon, so they give them up, and then eventually they might get a bit better. But it is a long term illness, especially people keep exposing themselves to it over and over again, and it's a lung
disease. Yeah, sounds awful.
It is, believe me.
Well, that's Paul on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now, for the past 127 years, Portmarnock Golf Club has not allowed women members. So, after a vote, 17% of members decided to stay men only, while 83% have ushered in the 21st century to allow female golfers to join if they can afford to. Here's Mary Wilson from Morning Ireland.
It's always good to see dinosaurs embracing change, but how did it happen and why did it happen now?
Well, certainly it's been a very slow process, 127 years. It is finally about time. It's quite a complicated background. Even, you know, there was a lot of legal action in 2009. Ultimately, it went to the Supreme Court, where basically Portmarnock were considered to be a discriminatory club. So but there was almost a sea change, even though that decision went in their favour. The tide started turning, and it's been a slow process. But finally, they've got it over the board. I know 16.6% voted against it, but I would suggest that 83.4% voting in favour, given the history that was there, is actually an overwhelming and a very clear majority.
Mm. And did this happen overnight, or has this happened some time ago?
Well, the vote actually took place in late March, and obviously it was being processed, and the I's were being dotted, the T's were being crossed just to make sure everything was in order. And, you know, it's a it's a historic vote, obviously, from Port Marnock, but to the vast majority of people who are golfers, would say it's about time. And I think there is a progressive element in Port Marnock in the last number of years who have pushed this with an eye, obviously, based on the gender issue, but also an awareness that historically Port Marnock Golf Club is a very famous club. It's probably in some way the home of golf in Ireland, in that it started the Irish Open. It has hosted the Canada Cup, which is the World Cup. It's hosted the Walker Cup. And hopefully this now opens the door for further things, including the Curtis Cup, which is the equivalent, the women's equivalent.
Is membership open? How much does it cost? Is there availability?
Well, I don't know how much it costs. I would imagine there's, if I can look at what happened in Muirfield in Scotland, in actual fact, Port Marnock are probably in the halfpenny place compared to them. They were 275 years before they admitted women members in 2019. And what they did then was they had a sort of a vetting process, and they invited 12 women members. So I don't expect the floodgates to open. It'll be a slow process again, but it is underway.
And just before I go to Anne McCormick, is that the end of it now? Is that the end of golf clubs in this country discriminating against 50% of the population?
Well, hopefully so. And I think a question mark will now be pointed towards Royal Dublin.
Why? Do they still not allow women in?
Well, they don't have it in their constitution, but they don't have women members. So I would say they're next up now for some finger pointing.
And Anne McCormick of Golf Ireland also spoke to Mary.
Now, you know golf, Anne, but it is baffling that this went on for so long and that they stuck, in the face of legal actions and all that happened, that they stuck so rigidly to this no women rule for so long.
Yeah, certainly. But I think, you know, we're moving towards you know, the vision that Golf Ireland has about being forward-thinking, modern and an inclusive organisation. And I think, you know, us as leading the way across the country with all the golf clubs, you know, Port Marnock stepping up, they did that. They made that change themselves. And we're really looking forward to watching. I think it's a really positive step forward. And we're looking forward to seeing how it rolls out with them.
Yeah, it is positive, but it did take such a long time. Do they need, though, now to take another step? Do they need to actively, Anne, encourage women to join their club?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, in fairness to Port Marnock, they've been making, you know, we've certainly helped them in the past. The legacy unions run family days. So I think that they are very open to this. I mean, obviously, with the overwhelming vote in favour of it. So I think, yeah, of course, they're going to be making steps, and hopefully, you know, Golf Ireland will be in a position to support them in that. We have a number of initiatives that will, you know, we've learned a lot about how to encourage women into the game through participation programmes, but equally, more than that, getting them on, hearing their voices on management committees. And I think, you know, Port Marnock, obviously, with this vote, you know, they're obviously wanting this change and hopefully are going to fully embrace it as well.
And Philip's saying there that it's not in the constitution, but Royal Dublin doesn't have women members. Would you like to see them also actively encouraging women to join and play there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, with Port Marnock leading this change themselves, I've no doubt that Royal Dublin will be looking inwardly and having a look. So, of course, while Golf Ireland can't compel any clubs to make the change, we are, you know, obviously trying to lead the drive towards change and influence it and be leaders ourselves in it. Because I think the important piece here is that, you know, for any clubs that we are encouraging or trying to, you know, talk about perhaps looking at their practices, we internally need to be doing our part, which can be seen through our signing up of the Women in Golf Charter. And we're delighted that, you know, there's nearly 200 of our golf clubs that have signed up. That's their commitment to inspire change.
That's Anne McCormick, Chief Operations Officer of Golf Ireland, for Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, epic journeys on uncharted land and humans driven to the brink of endurance. It's the great story at the heart of the book Madhouse at the End of the Earth. Writer Julian Sanction told Ryan how he was brought to this real-life voyage.
Yeah, so I was at my desk at Departures magazine at the time, and I was flipping through the pages of the New Yorker magazine, and there was an article about how NASA is planning on sending men and women to Mars, and they're studying the effects of confinement in isolation in extreme environments on the psychology of these astronauts. And the article began in unexpected fashion with a short summary of this expedition that I'd never heard about, the Belgica expedition. And in those three paragraphs, it evoked the image of people going insane near the South Pole. And that was just so gothic. It was just such a great detail. And then when I learned that one of the key factors in the survival of those who did survive was the presence of the American doctor Frederick Cook, who was later maligned as a great fraudster, a guy who lied about being the first to reach the North Pole, lied about being the first to reach the summit of the tallest mountain in America, and was imprisoned for 7 years for running a Ponzi scheme, the kind of combination P.T. Barnum and Bernie Madoff. Mm. When I heard that that guy was the hero of this trip, then that was just so irresistible. I love a heroic anti-hero. Mm. And so, yeah, that's what I decided to learn more about.
Okay, so it must have been so exciting. Let's assemble the cast of characters that would populate the Belgica, the boat that took us into the dark, as you say, Antarctic night. This reads like it's almost like an Agatha Christie setup of everyone has an interest in this thing being successful as it happens. But what a cast of characters! And let's start, I suppose, with the man at top. This is de Gerlache himself.
Yes. So it was his idea. Adrien de Gerlache was a Belgian aristocrat, a young man, probably 26 when he came up with this crazy idea, and it was a absurd passion for a Belgian at that time to have any seafaring dreams, because it was a country with no maritime tradition to speak of. They had no navy, a bare bones merchant marine, and any adventurer worth his salt at that time would have been more tempted to seek his fortune in the Congo. Mm. But de Gerlache had no appetite for colonialism, and he had his eye on colder horizons, and decided that he would heed the call of the World Geographic Societies, who at that time had decided that the exploration of the Antarctic, which was almost entirely unknown at that time, was of the utmost priority. And so he assembled, or rather scraped together, a ragtag group of what semi-qualified Belgian sailors he could find, a somewhat more reliable group of Norwegian sailors, and Eastern European scientists, this aforementioned American doctor. Mm. A lot of his staffing decisions were questionable, but there were a few that certainly made the difference later on. Cook was one, and another was the first mate of the expedition, a Norwegian man named Roald Amundsen, who would later become something of a legend for having blazed through the Northwest Passage and beaten Robert Falcon Scott to the South Pole. And possibly, if what we know now is accurate, it's always questionable, these achievements in polar regions, but possibly was the first to the North Pole. So for Roald Amundsen, the Belgica was a testing ground, an apprenticeship of sorts. Mm. And it's funny that the great legend of polar exploration should have learned so much from the great anti-hero, the great huckster of polar exploration, Frederick Cook. But he did. He revered him.
And Julian was talking about the ragtag crew that came together for the mission.
I think of it as one of those Men on a Mission movies, like the Dirty Dozen.
Yes.
And despite my education as a historian, I can't help make those cinematic comparisons either.
Well, it is cinematic as an experience, as a read, and as a story. And as you say, once you hear gothic, you know, we're going right back into that particular zone. Looking at them, even they have a great look. They're very young. They could fit into the East Village having beers in modern New York. Do you know what I mean? They look like hipsters.
They really do. I mean, they did. It helps that they let their beards grow. But later in the expedition, when the sun returns, the morale was so low that Frederick Cook decided that he needed to do something to keep spirits up, and so he gave everybody haircuts. And he had this habit of just cutting part of their hair and then letting them and refusing to cut the other side. So I'm sure they looked even more like East Village hipsters at that point.
Yeah, for sure. So many places to go. Let me just talk about how the anthropologist and the naturalist on board were. They're like children looking out the window, the porthole, go, stop here. I want to go over there. You know? And yet, exactly. the captain or the commandant was saying, stop asking. We have to get further. You're interrupted. And yet their curiosity is infectious right down through the passage of time for us now in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. And those were two incompatible aims. From the beginning, de Gerlache wanted to frame this as a serious scientific expedition. But at the same time, he realized that in order to get the public behind him, in order to he needed to promise some kind of exploit that would electrify the press and the public at large. And, the discovery of the mating patterns of the Gentoo penguin probably wasn't going to do the trick. So he promised the attainment of the South Magnetic Pole, which at that time had not been located. That's somewhat different from the South Geographic Pole. It's just where the center of magnetic activity in the South, in the polar regions. So whereas a thorough scientific expedition required that the scientists take as much time as they can, investigate every tide pool, every glacier, the attainment of a distant geographic goal required that they move as fast as possible. So those two problems ended up clashing and delayed the expedition. And by the time he set out for the geographic pole, it was far too late in the season and the winter ice was setting in. And so he had a decision to make. Do I come home empty-handed? Am I going to be able to show my face to my illustrious family and wonder what the Belgian press will make of this, or do I nevertheless pursue a relentless southern route, knowing full well that the ice will surround the ship and close in and possibly crush the ship? But if we do survive, we will be the first to endure the cruelties of an Antarctic winter. And that will be something we can crow about back home, because in exploration at that time, the real goal was to have a great story to tell, and he certainly succeeded there.
You've set up the story in many ways that now people can read the rest for themselves. But in the way you describe them, there are many shadows cast on the characters of this ship, the shadows of fame, the shadows of shame, shadows of ambition. And that great big yawning shadow of legacy.
Yeah. And those were, everybody dealt with those in different ways. De Gerlache was hamstrung by it. This fear of, it was as much a pursuit of glory as a fear of humiliation. But he was not, despite those dreams of glory, he was not himself a conqueror. And so that's something that I found somewhat admirable about him. Even though he made this decision and lied to the men about his decision to get caught in the ice, he claimed it was an accident, and he claimed that they were actually making progress towards the north when they were making progress towards the south, which defies belief to me.
And Julian spoke about the mental health effects of the journey.
It was a maddening environment. It was nature, especially down there, is a trickster, and not only the landscape, which was made entirely of water, it was, one of the men said, it was a parody of terra firma. It looked like a desert. It looked like you could trust every step, and looked like there were mesas and mountains in the distance, as reliable as nearby towns. But it was in constant flux. Every step could have been a light covering of snow over a hole or a patch of slush, and if you stepped on it, you would almost certainly die. You sink beneath the pack and die of hypothermia or drown. And the light as well played tricks. There were things that we've never seen outside of polar environments. Fog bows, parhelic circles, sun dogs. You mentioned the The beautiful southern lights, which were mesmerizing. And then you mentioned the mirages. There's such a thing as a Fata Morgana, which is particularly awesome, to use your word, mirage, where distant objects seem to float over the horizon or to be greatly extended or distorted or inverted. And indeed, in de Jolache's log, which I was lucky enough to access, he describes this in the most. He's one of the most remote humans in the world at that point, and yet he describes what he sees in the distance as a city by the sea, with a complete with a lighthouse shining towards him. So you know, these were they couldn't believe their eyes, and it was they couldn't trust their eyes rather. And so that definitely set the stage for a descent into madness as the sun disappeared for months.
The other aspect of nature that really struck me was the ferocity and the power and the cruelty of wind.
Yeah. It's you know, there's only two forces that affect the pack ice, and it's the same two forces that affect water. It's the current and the wind. And to think that those two things were responsible for all their suffering, for not only the incessant howling in the rigging, but also for the pressure of the ice, which is moved primarily by wind and current, and that the ship was at the mercy of these things, and especially of wind, something that can't even be touched or seen, that the wind should threaten them every day with destruction, I found also pretty gothic.
Julian Sanction, the book is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on the Ray Darcy Show, comedian, poet and all-round good egg, David O'Doherty was talking to Ray about his new book in the afternoon.
Great to talk to you. We haven't spoken in a long time.
It's true. I'm hard to get.
You are? Know? Why is that, can I ask you?
Well, I was living on Ackle Island for five months.
But, I know, but even before that. I suspect you don't particularly like doing interviews.
I don't have a lot to say. Yeah. Look at Collie Ennis. I follow him on Twitter and see weird pictures of his house with his massive lizards and huge hairy spiders and him saying, don't worry about this. That's the sort of person you should have on this show. Not some old busker who went to live on Ackle for a while.
Listen, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I've read it. I have my 8-year-old reading it as well. He hadn't finished it, so he didn't give a review, but he's really enjoying it. I heard him laugh out loud from his room last night as he was reading through it. So, well done.
That's all. The only reason I write for children is, like, honestly, I mean this, about three times in my childhood, I remember my ma or my dad coming into the room at about 10:30 or 11 on a school night to tell me to put the light off, and it was too late. And I was just being kept awake by a book that I couldn't put down. And that's all I'm trying to do, Ray.
Well, you've done it successfully with this. And this is, although you've done Dangers Everywhere, three of those?
Yeah.
This is the first novel, you know, official, isn't it? That's why do you laugh? It is the first novel. It's a children's novel. Are you saying
it could win the Booker or the Nobel Prize? Because, yeah, I'm into that.
So the Ackle thing, we'll talk more about the book, and we have a number of reviewers who've sent us in there. We sent them out the book, so you should be a bit nervous about that. We have those standing by. But first, the whole Ackle experience, because so did it happen by accident or was it by design that you ended up in Ackle for lockdown?
I mean, if we go right back to the 1950s, basking sharks were a big thing in Ackle, and my grandfather and my grandmother went down there because he imported outboard engines. So since the 50s, there has been a O'Doherty presence on the island. And so my adorable parents were 82 this time last year. And so at the first sniff of pandemic, my career ended was the first thing that happened. All known gigs were cancelled pretty much overnight on about the 10th of March. Yeah. I had a breakup, so there was no reason to stick around in Dublin. So it was just like, should we move to Ackle then? And I remember at the time it was slightly terrifying because no one really knew what was going to happen. But also we all thought it would last probably about a month.
Yeah.
So we go to Ackle for March. Sure, that'll be gas. Fast forward to July.
You're still there, still in lockdown.
So, yeah, there was the opportunity to do certain other things that I've always wanted to do. I always wanted to do to become a broadcaster like yourself, Ray. Nice, so I did a daily podcast.
But you'd said previously that you'd never do a podcast. So, you know, things, strange things happened to people during lockdown, didn't they? They went back on their word. You did say that, didn't you?
I've said a lot of things in the past. Yeah. I said I'd never get Twitter, and now look at me checking the whole thing the whole time. Yeah. Instagram, the whole lot. But no, my life lost all shape moving to Ackle at the time. So I rang my friend Mark, who's one of the second captain's lads, and I said, how would you like it if I did a 20-minute podcast? And he was like, great, once a week? No, every day for as long as this lasts. So it ended up going on, as you'll remember, for quite some time.
Yes.
And my podcast went on for quite some time. But that was the morning, and then there was the afternoon. So I'd go for a cycle, and then I'd write a bit of a book.
So let's bring on the critics.
Now, we'll go to Rowan. Rowan, age 12 first. He's from Galway. And he's the serious one of the reviewers. And I think he has a future in literary critiques. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Rowan Murphy. I am 12 years old and I live in Galway City. The Summer I Robbed a Bank is about a boy called Rex and his adventure with his uncle on an island off the coast of Mayo. It is an easy, funny read with a good storyline. The book deals with serious life situations in a funny way. My favourite character is Uncle Derm because he is so laid back and makes the best out of bad situations. I also enjoyed the relationship between Rex and Kitty, as Rex is a quiet, shy boy and Kitty is a live-life-on-the-edge kind of person. Kitty made Rex more confident in certain situations, and I would recommend this book to 10-plus-year-olds.
Now, there you go. Thanks, Rowan, for that. Rowan Murphy.
Thank you, Rowan. That's exactly what we were going for. There is some serious stuff in the book. I lost one of my best friends a few years ago, and I was just so utterly impressed and loved the way that he kind of knew that he was on the way out and the way that he lived his last while. And so I wanted to put a bit of that into the book. So, yeah, thank you very much, Rowan.
That's Rowan. And the next up, a family. We have, let's see, I better get them right here now. Donal, Cora and Ross. Donal is 11, Cora is 9 and Ross is 7. And they're from Inishannon in West Cork.
Hi. I'm Cora and I'm 9 years old.
My name is Ross Horn. I'm 7 years old.
Hi, I'm Donal and I'm 11 years old and we're from West Cork.
We got the book from David O'Doherty.
That's you. Yeah.
Called The Summer I Robbed the Bank. My favourite character is Rex because he thinks his name is a dog's name and I like dogs.
Rex is a bit boring at the start, but turns out to be the best character because he gets braver.
My favourite character was Derm because he squeezes every last drop of joy into his life and it's really heartwarming and nice.
I love the way little Ross says, a bit boring. It's a bit boring. Yeah. These are enjoyable, aren't they? You're enjoying the reviews, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I didn't know what way Ross was going to take it there. Imagine if he just absolutely hammered it. My confidence. This is the first reviews the book's got. I'd be in ribbons.
David O'Doherty on The Ray D'Arcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.